Good evening. It's good to see you again. I appreciate your coming. Thank you for the beautiful day that you arranged for your visitor. It was just beautiful today, and I appreciate the kindness of getting to know many of you and your willingness to come out on Monday night after a busy Sunday. Hope you'll do it again tomorrow and Wednesday as well. Scotland, capital city, Edinburgh, a divided city today, a new city down below a ravine which separates the city from the upper city, bridged today by a modern bridge. But the upper city was the old town. It was primarily one long mile street, the Royal Mile, as it was called. It was called High Street, H-I-G-H, because it was in the high part of town. At one end of this mile was the Edinburgh Castle. It's still there, built on a promontory, impossible to surprise attack this castle, a defense. It was the center of government. At the other end, exactly a mile at the end of the road, was the palace where the queen or the king, depending on which one they had at the time, resided. About halfway between those two buildings was St. Giles Church. It was a Roman Catholic church originally. It is today a Presbyterian church. It was John Knox's pulpit. In the lower town today, the new town, the modern town, is a tall spire. It's not on top of a church. It's on the ground. But it rises some six or seven stories and ends in a cupola, an open area, in which is a statue of Sir Walter Scott, the great Scottish poet, novelist, the great hero in Scottish literature. By contrast, alongside the rear of St. Giles Church is a small statue of John Knox. John Knox is hardly remembered in Scotland today, though if you look for his monument, you hear the phrase, "Scotland is his monument." It's the 16th century. Scotland is the northern part of the island of Britain, as the Romans called it. The southern half of it is England. And then alongside is a separate island that we know as Ireland. The northern part of this island of Britain is Scotland. The Scots and the English never got along well. There was a mutual hatred between the two cultures. The English looked upon the Scots as backward and barbarian, and the Scots looked upon the English as snooty and uppity and sophisticated snobs. That has not all disappeared even today. You remember in Roman times, a wall was built separating England from Scotland. The Emperor Hadrian built a wall to keep the Scots out. And the Scots were quite happy not to have the English in. 16th century. An average family was mine. I want to make a transition now into the first person and ask you to believe that I am John Knox and I have come to tell you the story of my life. Born sometime between 1505 and 1514. Now, that's a long time to argue about, but scholars do. So imprecise were birth records in those days, and nobody really cared. Nobody was important when he was born, unless he was a prince or a princess. Wait a while, and we'll find out if it's worth remembering. Born to an average family, eventually able to attend St. Andrew's University. Andrew was the patron saint of Scotland by tradition. Scotland was a priest-ridden country. It was dominated by the church. More important than the king or queen was the cardinal. And in my early adulthood, it was Cardinal Beaton was his name, B-E-A-T-O-N. He put many good men to death for preaching the gospel. One of them was Patrick Hamilton, 24 years old, went to Wittenberg to attend the university to hear Martin Luther. He drank in Reformation truth that salvation was by faith alone, that the scriptures were alone the authority for the believer. And he came back to Scotland and he preached that truth. And he was burned as a heretic for daring to deny the teachings of the church. The Church of Rome, the only organized, permitted ecclesiastical system at the time. It was later said to the cardinal, if you must burn heretics, burn them in the cellar, for the smoke of Hamilton's burning has infected all on whom it blew. They deliberately, publicly burned heretics as a warning to the people of the hell-bound sinner that was about to be dispatched to the place of his choosing because of his departure from the teachings of the church. But Hamilton's example was heard, was seen, was felt, and was believed by many others. In my adulthood, it was George Wishart, my friend, my companion. I was, in a sense, his bodyguard and companion. And he was burned for preaching the gospel. This had a very serious effect upon me, a young priest. And I heard the gospel as proclaimed by these good men. And I embraced the gospel as proclaimed by these good men. And I was willing to be burned with Wishart. And he said, no, John, one beast is enough for one sacrifice. Live and serve for a future day. I did not know what prophecy that contained, but God did preserve me. I soon was invited by a group of nobility who took over the castle of Cardinal Beaton, and they hanged him in rebellion against what he had done to God's men. It was not right to do that, but they did that. And they invited me to be their chaplain. I entered that castle with them, and soon the French came to relieve the castle, captured us all, and for 19 months we were galley slaves on a French ship. We were chained to the oarlocks and rowed, regardless of the weather, regardless of the storm, propelling the French ship. France was the friend of Scotland. England was the enemy of Scotland. Now, in the time of Henry VIII, in the early 16th century, Henry VIII's father arranged a marriage. I don't want to get too technical here, but this is significant for what is to come. Arranged a marriage of his daughter, that is a sister to Henry VIII, to the King of France, the King of Scotland, to the King of Scotland, hoping thereby to weld together the two countries, to create friendship between them. This was a nice idea, but it did not work. The next generation deliberately married a French princess, and France was England's enemy, and snubbed in the face of England. So the King of Scotland married, who was the child of the marriage which was intended to weld together England and Scotland, deliberately married into the family of England's enemy. And that princess, who became the Queen of Scotland, was Mary Guise. Her husband was James the Fifth. Well, I'll get too technical. The significance of this is that there was bad blood still between England and Scotland. But there was warm blood, if there were, between France and Scotland. And the French captured us, and through the heat of two summers and the cold of one winter, we rowed on a French galley. They regularly brought a painted wooden image of the Virgin Mary to us and required each of us to kiss her. Thus, deliberately challenging our faith. And when it came to me, with the degree of freedom I had with our chains, I took her and I flung her overboard into the sea. And I said, Our Lady is more fit to swim than to be kissed. And for that action, I suffered the lash on the tilted board, head downward on a flat board, lashed to the board and whipped on the board. But they never brought her around again. They never replaced that image. Eventually, after 19 months, I say, the King of England intervened. He was Edward the Sixth, the boy king, the godly young man, who was a teenager when he became the monarch and was still a teenager when he died, infirm of body, but strong of mind and soul, probably nurtured in the faith by Thomas Cranmer, one of those of the scripture men at Cambridge University who were one of the fellows in the White Horse Inn with whom Tyndall had good conversations. Released, freed, and I went to the border between Scotland and England and became a pastor in the town of Berwick. A pastor, a Christian pastor, a Protestant pastor. And before long, I say, this boy king of England died, was succeeded by his elder sister. She is Mary. A lot of Marys involved here. She is the Mary you know as Bloody Mary. She is the Mary who was the daughter of the Catholic queen, the first of the marriages of Henry VIII. and she resented the efforts of her half-brother to Protestantize England and wished to reverse it. And she set out to deliberately destroy the leadership of the Protestant movement in England. And some 300 were put to death during her mercifully brief reign of 5 years. Well, it was obvious that I could not remain in the face of this conflict. I would either become a Marian martyr or a Marian exile. I chose to be an exile while I could. And I went to the continent. I went first to Frankfurt in Germany, and then found my way to Geneva in Switzerland, where John Calvin had begun a reform movement, had transformed a city, a commercial city of great importance, into a place of remarkable peace and prosperity and piety. It was a remarkable place, even as late as the 19th century, when people took the grand tour of Europe and kept a log, a diary of their experiences. They reported the peace and the prosperity and the tolerance and the joy that prevailed in the city of Geneva. Well, I went to Geneva, and Tyndale's New Testament had been at work there, and as it was back in Scotland before long. And I learned much by watching and observing what was being done there, and how the City Council of Geneva passed laws requiring the preaching of the gospel from the scriptures every Lord's Day, and put restrictions on public vices, and tried to create an environment of righteousness. They could not change hearts thereby, but those who had an affinity for godliness found it a comfortable and pleasant place. And those who did not fled if they did not get converted. It was a remarkable center, and I was given the privilege of being a Bible teacher. In those days, they distinguished teacher from pastor and presbyter. The teacher was the Bible teacher, and he daily throughout the week conducted lessons in a chapel adjacent to what had been the cathedral. It's St. Peter's Cathedral in Geneva, standing today, but it was whitewashed. All the Romanist trappings were removed in Calvin's time, and it became a Puritan-looking edifice, very appropriate to the preaching of the gospel, an elevated pulpit which could be seen and from which the speaker could be heard throughout. It was a conversion of the apostate edifice into a place where blessing was possible. For several years, about 3 years, I remained there in Geneva and learned much in the experience. And then Bloody Mary had passed off the scene, and I returned to Scotland. In the meantime, in my country, in Scotland, God had been at work with the Word of God, and the nobility and the merchants rose up and signed a national covenant establishing the gospel as the law of the land. They outlawed the Mass in Scotland. Imagine that. In the 16th century, imagine that. And they said, we will have nothing but the gospel in our land. Now, we will argue about, you will argue in your culture, in your day, in your 21st century, about the wisdom of enforcing religious unity by the state. But in that time, The state was assumed to be the protector of the people. And spiritual protection was the highest form of protection. And so the church, the state, having had centuries of ecclesiastical corruption and power, sought to make the Bible the standard. They drew up a catechism. They drew up a standard of doctrine. And they became the covenanters. And much later, many of them were to lose their lives as the crown changed from century to century. I came back into this, and I became the pastor of St. Giles Cathedral, St. Giles Church. On this royal mile, this high street, my pulpit was so situated that it within the church that it faced in the direction of the palace at the other end of the road. And now, the crown. The crown of Scotland is being held for the young queen, daughter of this James V, who was born in France, who was the daughter of the French princess, who had become the Queen of Scotland. But she, the Queen of Scotland, resented the boorishness of the Scots, had no patience with them. She was accustomed to the finery and the fashion of France. And she wanted her daughter to be reared in that finery and fashion. And faith, as it turned out, the faith of Rome. So when the king, father, died, while the daughter, the princess, was too young to assume the throne, the mother, the queen, became the regent, the one ruling in behalf of her daughter. She, the regent, ruled in Edinburgh at the royal palace. She was not the queen. She was the queen mother. She was the regent for the queen. The queen was in diapers still. And the regent wanted her daughter to be reared in all of the finery and fashion of France. And soon in the morals of France as well. And this young girl became a wife at 19, and she married the son of the king of France and was about to become the queen of France as well. He was not yet the king, but he was in line to become the king. And if that had been true, she, the young Mary, the young princess, would bring Scotland into the throne of France. And the King of France would be King of France and Scotland. And the Scottish did not like this prospect one bit. And that would re-Romanize Scotland. And they opposed it. And they were getting ready to put up a fuss if this fell through. As it turned out, that young King of France, that king-to-be, died within a few months of the marriage. She was a widow, still at 19. Scotland was saved from that prospect. And about this time, her mother dies, that is, the regent dies, and she, Mary, Queen of Scots, now, comes back to Scotland, to a land that has become a Protestant kingdom in her absence. And she is an alien in her own land. She comes to the palace. She takes residence in the palace. There is in the palace a royal chapel. The first day she is back in her palace, she has her private priest perform a mass. This is against the law of France. The Scottish nobility raise their voice against her. But she is the sovereign. I am in my pulpit. I raise my voice. against the action of the Queen. I do not condemn the Queen. I condemn what she has done. Who of all the citizens is most responsible to uphold the law? The sovereign. And the sovereign, above all citizens, has broken the law. A law by the people, by the leadership of the land established. I preach against the action. I receive a summons to the palace Monday morning. She is a possessor of all of the feminine wiles, and she uses them. She cajoles, she flatters, she threatens, she weeps, she scolds, and this preacher is not moved. She says, I perceive that my people will obey you rather than me. And I reply calmly, it is more important, madam, that both obey God. Who are you in my kingdom anyway? I am a faithful subject and a profitable one withal. What is it your business what my religion is? Religion is a private matter. I believe my religion is right, she says. And I say, right religion, madam, demandeth right knowledge. And of right knowledge, I fear thou hast none. I was respectful to the madam. She said, you will not long be, when I said I must return to my study, if you have nothing more to say. She said, you shall not long be in your study. And I said, madam, I fear I shall be longer in my study than you shall be on your throne. That was no threat. It was an observation that was soon to prove true. Are you yet of the generation that has been reared on Mother Goose nursery rhymes? Any of you remember any of those? You betray your longevity. In my time, it was not possible to write a letter to the editor or to express a dissenting opinion from authority without reaping consequences. So the people had a way of devising little ditties which the children sang in the streets as they played. They didn't know what they meant. And I dare say many of you have not known about little Miss Muffet, who sat on a tuffet eating her curds and whey. Along came a spider and sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away. Miss Muffet is Mary, Queen of Scots. The tuffet is her throne on which she is calmly sitting. The spider is John Knox, who comes along. Sat down, I was called many times to converse with her. She always summoned me. I never initiated the meeting. She was constantly conscious that there was a struggle in place, and unless something were settled, her days were numbered. And the line ends, and frightened Miss Muffet away. In 1567, Mary, Queen of Scots, was given her walking papers. In her paycheck was a pink slip saying her services were no longer required. She was deposed from the throne. But I am queen by the will of God. But you are not queen by the will of the people whom you have offended, or by the law which you have broken. She fled. She put up a brief resistance. And it was not only her failure to uphold the law, but it was the mess she had made of her personal life that further offended the sensitivities of the Scottish morality. She was a widow at 19. She came to Scotland. She married a distant cousin, Henry Darnley, who loved her and whom she betrayed with their Italian male secretary. When discovered, he, the husband, was so enraged that he arranged the sudden murder of the lover, and she married the murderer of the lover within months of the event. And after losing interest in him, she was about to marry Don Pedro, the son of the King of Spain, which would further guarantee the Romanization of Scotland. And this was too much for the Scottish people. She was deposed. She fled to England. She fled to England because on the throne now was Elizabeth, the last of the children of Henry VIII. Elizabeth is the last of the Tudors. If anything happens to Elizabeth, waiting to assume the throne is Mary, Queen of Scots, because Mary is the granddaughter of an English queen who had been married to the King of Scotland and so forth. Now, what is Elizabeth going to do with Mary, Queen of Scots? What Elizabeth does is to give her a palace as a prison. A palace with its grounds, nothing confined except liberty to leave, to come and go. All of her visitors were screened by order of Elizabeth. Any communications she sent were suspiciously noted. She was put in a kind of house arrest, but what a house. But protected from being able to do anything to win the support of the English people. Eventually, Elizabeth discovered Mary's plot involving the King of Spain, whom she promised to marry if he would invade England and take over and Romanize England. And finally, Elizabeth consented, seemingly unwillingly, to her execution. And Mary was executed, finally, in England. But she left behind a son, 1 year old, when she fled Scotland. By now, the King of Scotland, his name is James. He's named after the father, her father. He is James the VI of Scotland. With the death of Elizabeth, he becomes James the I of England. He retains both titles. As he comes to England to assume the second throne, he is met by a group of Puritan fathers, churchmen, Protestant believers, who propose to him a number of changes, one of which is the creation of a new edition of the Scriptures in English, which is the birth of the so-called Authorized Version. It is this James after whom the King James Version is named. He had relatively little to do with it. He permitted it, and they were grateful for that permission, so they dedicated it to him when completed. I'm back in Scotland. The Queen has been deposed. A civil government had been established based on the boy prince, now king, James the Sixth. He is reared a godly Protestant believer. He is counseled by these covenanters who nurture him in the faith of the gospel. And I grow older, and the 1570s have arrived, and I have come to approach the end of my years. I left three daughters only, so there's no Knox family subsequently. In fact, I married very late, and it was said by my friends to be a marriage of May and October. I was October. She was 18. She was May. We had three daughters, I say, one of whom married Josiah Welch, a later godly preacher who was arrested under the Catholic Stuart kings of England for preaching the gospel. And my daughter, Mrs. Welch, went to the king and requested that he, who had been imprisoned in England, be transferred into Scotland so that she could more easily visit him. And the king replied, "I will be glad to accommodate you, madam, if your husband will renounce his false faith in your gospel." And she, my daughter, lifted the tunic that covered her skirt and held it before the king and said, "I would rather have his head here." And I was proud of that knowledge and of that testimony. I had sailed in the ark of the gospel, in the ark of safety, toward that shore from which there is no returning. It was 1572. I approached my pulpit for the last time. I installed my successor in the pastorate there, and walked slowly, leaning on the arm of a friend, to my home on the high street. Entered it, having passed by a mile-long street lined with my people and illuminated by the light of a people's love. Entered into my home, from which I was not in this life again to emerge. 8 days later, on the second Monday following that last Sunday, at noontime I asked my dear wife to read to me from the 15th of 1 Corinthians, the chapter on the resurrection. At 6 o'clock, the family retired for family prayers. They returned after some time and asked if I had heard their prayers. And I replied, "I heard a heavenly sound." And at about 10 o'clock in the evening, I requested that my dear wife read to me from that 17th chapter of John, where I first cast my anchor. And having completed it, my secretary, my servant secretary, asked if I still held to the doctrines I have preached. And feebly I lifted three fingers heavenward and said, "It is well with my body, with my spirit, and with my soul." And at 11 o'clock in the evening, I departed, having cast anchor for the last time from that ark in which I had sailed those decades since I had been influenced by the smell of Hamilton's burning. and arrived at that shore, never to sail again. Scotland is my monument. Scotland has given your country more presidents and statesmen than any other country. That Presbyterian Republican concept on which the Republic is based has been part of the legacy of my native land. John Knox, K-N-O-X, not well known. He has been called the Thundering Scot. It is said that when he preached, he would start off calmly with his text and warm to his text and flay the pulpit as he made his points. And the surface of the pulpit was regularly replaced. God used a common man, uncommonly, to bless a nation. And with that nation, many others. God uses men and women. He could use angels. He invites you and me to be his servants. Some of them become well known. Most of us are forgotten soon after we lie in dust, if not before. But God sees, God rewards. He rewards faithfulness, not achievement. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Be thou, be I, be all.